You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Norman Lear is one of only a few writer-producers to have transformed television. His shows like All in the Family, The Jeffersons, Maude, Good Times, and Mary Hartman featured people who had never been seen on the small screen before, and they dealt with things that had never been discussed in a sitcom setting, issues of gender, race, class, bigotry, abortion, impotence, and transgender politics. They became the topics people discussed at water coolers and offices all over America. In an age when television was network, or mostly network, Mr. Lear once had 5 shows in the top 10, which meant tens of millions of viewers were watching each week. He tells the story of his life in his book, Even This I Get to Experience. He was a guest on our show in October, and we're rebroadcasting that conversation for you on this New Year's Eve. At the peak of your success, how many people were watching your shows?
Well, I was introduced once by Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes and was surprised to hear him say 120 million people are watching his shows these days.
Wow, that was about one-third of the country or even a little more.
It was.
And it's impossible to get those numbers now with so many cable channels in the mix. You came along at the right time, near the end of the dominance of the networks?
The beginning of television and straight through to the end of the dominance of the networks.
At the time, did you feel that what you were doing was political? Were you on a mission?
I was on no mission. As a matter of fact, at the very beginning, when people used to say, there's Western Union if you want to send a message.
Yeah, Samuel Goldwyn supposedly
said. I don't know how many people remember Western Union today. And I would say, we're not sending messages, we're just doing our thing. And I began to realize after some time that for all the years that preceded our shows, the problems that existed on a family show was the boss is ruined, the roast is ruined, the boss is coming to dinner. And there was kind of a bigger message than we were sending in all of that. There was, wall-to-wall, there was no economic problems in America, no racial problems in America, no disease, no, everything was perfect. Father knows best. So we weren't sending a message any stronger when we were doing shows on real problems. Then I thought we had been, television had dealt with before.
Your career was always in high gear. When were you able to slow down to look back and write this book?
I don't know about the word slowing down. It doesn't seem like anything changed. Got up every morning with something on my mind and did it. But I told myself I wanted to write a book at least 20 years ago and began noting and collecting and so forth. It was about 6 years ago I said to myself, now.
Well, you were already 87 at the time.
6 years ago, that would be almost correct, yeah.
In retrospect, is there anything you would have done differently? Would you have chosen different parents or different wives?
The way I am feeling at this moment, I wouldn't have changed anything. Whatever it took to get me here, I am happy with.
You begin the book when you were living away from your family and your father was in prison. What was he in prison for?
He attempted to sell some fake bonds. He was going to Oklahoma. He was going to bring me back a 10-gallon hat. And my mother was saying, I don't like those men you're going with, Herman. I don't want you to see those men. And he would say, stifle. That's, of course, where Archie got it. Stifle yourself, Jenna. And when he came back, he had no hat. And he was arrested.
How old were you?
I was 9.
Did that absence create a yearning for a father?
Oh, God, how hard to talk about.
Well, you present your father. He's something of a rascal, but, I mean, he was a felon.
He was a felon. It's hard, very hard for me to face up to that. And I have faced up to it. But every time I go back to it, I think I want to say rascal. Because underneath it all, I loved him a great deal.
And as you suggested earlier with the stifle, he was an inspiration for Archie Bunker, any of the other characters?
He used to call me the laziest white kid he ever met. And I would yell at him. He was putting down a race of people to call his son lazy, and he would say, "That's not what I'm doing, and you're the dumbest white kid I ever met." So, yeah, he had a lot of Archie in him.
And then you tell a defining story about your mother. When you were told that you're about to be named to the newly created Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame, you called to tell her. And how did she react?
Well, I told her that I was being inducted among the first with William Paley and David Sarnoff. They invented network television. And Patty Chayefsky, the greatest writer, and Edward R. Murrow, the best of the television journalists, Milton Berle, Lucille Ball, and me. And she said, "Listen, if that's what they want to do, who am I to say?"
It sounds like you were born into a sitcom.
In a sense, maybe we were all born into sitcoms.
But did you, all you foolish, need was a pencil?
The foolishness of the human condition is everywhere.
Now, you didn't start out to be a writer, but didn't you ghostwrite a poem for your father to give to your mother on their anniversary?
I did. They were going to be married 15 years. He asked me to do this, and I'll recite the poem because Edith recited it on an early episode of All in the Family. She read it aloud because it had been prepared ostensibly by Archie for her, and it was really Mike who wrote it. The 15 years I've been with you, we've spent many we've had many a tear, 'tis true. But life with us has just begun. We've yet to have all our fun as long as we're together. And when, my dear, we are old and gray, we'll look back on our lives and say, it has been fun together.
So how did your mother react to that the first time? And then later when she saw Edith say it on All in the Family?
She reacted to it well enough to have had it framed, and it hung in our vestibule all the years we were in that home. And she never knew that her son had written it. Edith reacted with, "Oh my, I'll bet it's a Hallmark." "Well, almost," she said when she looked at it. And then there was a little gift with it. And she opened it and she said, what was that razor that was meant for women? She didn't say this. I'm saying it because I can't remember the...
There was a Gillette razor that was for women.
A lady Gillette. Yeah. That's what it was. She said, "Oh, my, a lady Gillette."
That was the present.
That was the present, yeah.
Norman Lear is here. His memoir is called Even This I Get to Experience. What does that title refer to?
Well, I think it was the title from the beginning because I was amazed at my life. I mean, just this, I think of it now, even this I get to experience sitting here with you. Friends waiting to take me someplace else to talk about a book I love. I will wake up tomorrow morning to whatever I'm about to eat. I love eating. And I will think, even this.
You went to Emerson College and...
I did.
And your time there was interrupted by Pearl Harbor. So you enlisted?
I enlisted, yes. Not as quickly as I wished to because my mother begged me. As a college student, I didn't have to enlist. I could have been deferred until I graduated. But I just had to fight. I mean, I had to be in the troops or somehow.
And where did you serve?
I served in the 15th Air Force, flying over Germany, bombing Germany.
After the war, you started a career in public relations. Why did you choose that profession?
I was a kid of the Depression. I had one uncle, my Uncle Jack, who used to flick me a quarter every time he saw me. I thought that was the best thing in the world, to be an uncle who could flick a quarter. My folks didn't seem to expect anything. They didn't ask me what I wanted to be. My mother once thought I could be a cantor, because she heard me singing in the shower. But I wanted to be an uncle who could flick a quarter to a nephew.
So you decided to move to Hollywood.
So I decided to move to California, yes.
And what advice did your mother give you?
I was a press agent for a little while. And, that was after the war.
Mm-hmm. Your mother gave you advice when you decided to move to California? Your mother is a character.
My mother is a real character. My father's advice was to buy a convertible in the East, sell it in the West, and make the money for the trip.
Well, that sounds true to his style.
It was true to his style.
You already had a family, so you were taking a big chance here.
Yes, we took my little girl wasn't quite 2 years old, and we drove to California. And arrived there on a Saturday evening, the most remarkable Saturday evening of my life to this date.
Why?
You're going to ask me why. I knew you would.
Yes.
I parked my family in a little motel and went out on a Saturday night to get a Sunday newspaper, an early newspaper, because everyone knew it was difficult to find a place to live in Los Angeles at that time, and drove off the Sunset Boulevard once I'd found my paper and happened on the Stage Theater, which was a theater made out of a little housing complex, 90-seat theater. Couldn't have been more adorable. And there was a marquee said, show us Major Barber playing tonight. I got to talking to a guy sweeping up in front of the thing. He turned out to be the producer. We talked about possibly I could work there as a press agent, no pay, but maybe that would get me a start. Then he offered me a seat to see my favorite show in the English language, written by my favorite author. And I had to call my wife and tell her first night in California, sorry, honey, you have to be alone with the baby. I am going to see this show. It's a terrible moment.
You couldn't have gotten a seat for her as well? You had the kids.
She had the baby she had to take care of. And I went in and sat down. There were three seats in front of me as the lights dimmed. I had just noticed that Sidney Chaplin, whose name I didn't know, was in the cast. Turned out to be the son of Charlie Chaplin, who walked in as the lights were dimming with Alan Mowbray, a very famous actor, and Dame, I often lose her name.
Edith?
Dame Edith.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, Dame Edith, whatever. And they sat immediately in front of me. When the show was over, there was no backstage, so Mr. Chaplin had no place to go backstage. The cast came out to him. And, of course, none of us moved so long as he was sitting there. And he got up by way of thanking the cast who were sitting on the floor in front of him. And he said that when he was as moved as he was by this production, he always feels the only way he can pay back saying he loved it wasn't good enough. He would have to do something for them. And then he proceeded to perform an inebriated male trying to mail a letter. He had to get to a letterbox 18 feet away in a high wind. And he was hilarious, and I was weeping. My first night in California.
And you didn't ask me before when I asked you what your mother said to you. She said, Hollywood is not for you. Oh, you must have thought, yeah. Oh, yes, it is. But you had to sell furnishings from door to door. How long before you were able to get into writing?
Well, I had a first cousin out there, my cousin Elaine. She was married to a fellow by the name of Ed Simmons. Our wives became friends. They went to the movies one night. Eddie said, why don't you help me with something? And he was writing a parody to the Sheik of Araby, a well-known tune at the moment. When the girls came home from the movies, oh, my God, I said, well, the girls, we don't say girls today. When the women came home from the movies, we went out and at my suggestion, we went to a nightclub. And we sold this parody for $35. My nearly $20 was as much as I made the previous week selling door to door. And so we started to write every night.
And we will pick up on that after we take a little break. My guest is Norman Lear. His memoir, Even This I Get to Experience, it is published by Penguin Press. Stay with us. ¶¶
We're back with a rebroadcast of a conversation I had with television producer Norman Lear in October. His memoir is called Even This I Get to Experience.
So you start writing comedy with your cousin, and then you got Danny Thomas's phone number. How did you get?
Well, I read that William Morris was his talent representative, and I called. I had an idea for him, and called his office, made sure it was in the lunch hour, hoping he'd be away and I could talk to his secretary. And he was at lunch. And as fast as I could talk, I said, "My name is Merle Robinson." That was the name I used. Why I do know, it's another story. But my name is Merle Robinson. I'm with the New York Times. I've been spending the last couple of days with Mr. Thomas. Oh, my God, they're calling my plane. I have two questions. I'm writing my piece on the plane. I'll file it as soon as I get there. I need his number. She gave me the number. I called his number, and to my luck, he picked up the phone. He was working with his accompanist, whose name was Wally Pop. How I remember that, I don't know. And they were looking for something new or something that would be new to a Ciro's crowd that he was some cause-oriented evening the next night. And I said, well, our piece would be new, would be fresh. And he said, well, it has to be short. I have to learn it. So I said, it'll be short enough. It'll be 5 minutes or such. And he said, all right, get over here right away. I said, well, it's going to take about 3 hours, maybe 3.5 hours. He said, you said you're in Hollywood. I'm in Beverly Hills. It'll take you 20 minutes. But we hadn't written this piece yet.
Of course.
So,
did you have even an idea of
so
what you were going to write?
I don't know what the hell I said. It had something to do with it. He said, if you're not here by 5 o'clock, forget it. We were there by 5 o'clock. He sold it. And we sold it to him. He did it the next evening. And we were backstage at Ciro's in the kitchen, you know, peeking through, watching him make some faces we recognized laugh.
Now, you then worked in early television. You did some sketches for School for Comics with people like Jackie Gleason performing in them. Then you also worked for Martin and Lewis.
Yes.
Now, Jerry Lewis was not one of the best guests I've ever had on this show. Was he as difficult for you as he was for me?
Well, there were two Jerry Lewises. There was the original Jerry Lewis, because we did the very first Colgate Comedy Hour, their very first appearance on television. And he was hilarious. I mean, he was just as funny as it was possible for a human being to be, I thought, physically, emotionally, mentally. And when they caught on and when he became famous, I write in the book that some comics are inclined to become the Pope. They are all-knowing. And Jerry was as all-knowing eventually as anybody could possibly be. And that showed every year for sure on his muscular dystrophy telethon. He couldn't have been more stuffy and all-knowing.
Now, you had to adjust your writing style to each of these different people. Did you find that easy to do? And how successful do you think you were? Looking back, do you think you were really doing good stuff?
Well, it's interesting. But Martin Lewis, the very first sketch we wrote for them couldn't have been more interesting because I did think I was writing something that had some impact. And I'll tell you what that was in a moment, if I may, but Jerry destroyed it, I thought, by ad-libbing and going off the script and et cetera, et cetera. However, I learned a couple of weeks later the show had I couldn't have imagined that the sketch would have the impact it had. It was it was at a time when the motion picture studios were afraid of television. Television was going to take its audience. And so they had a campaign, movies are better than ever, to convince people they had to come to the movies. The sketch we did on that very first opening Martin and Lewis show was about a theater that had nobody inside of it. Dean was its manager. Can't remember her name, but she was the beauty of the moment, who was a guest on the show. And she was vamping passers-by to get them into the theater. Jerry Lewis came along bouncing a ball. And he was a victim. And Dean was on the one hand trying to get him in. She was trying to get him in. And he wanted no part of that. He was going to go home and so forth. Well, the result of the of that sketch on television caused Martin Lewis to take out a full-page ad apologizing to the Motion Picture Association for that sketch.
That's not the reason you were fired by them.
No, that's not. I have no idea why I was fired.
But then that broke up your partnership with Ed. But then you found Bud Yorkin, and that had to be a great find.
Well, Bud Yorkin was, along with several others who were well-known, Arthur Penn and John Rich, they were stagehands on the Colgate Comedy Hour. Mm-hmm. So we had a long friendship.
And then you started working the movies despite the fact that you had caused all that trouble. You met Neil Simon.
Well, Neil Simon.
You met
Simon,
him on TV first?
Yes. We were doing, Eddie and I were doing the Martha Ray Show, and Neil Simon. We hired his brother, Danny Simon. Mm-hmm. And his he came in with his young brother, Doc. He was known as Doc Simon at the beginning. And they worked for us for a couple of weeks. And then Neil, Doc, went on to become Neil and the biggest playwright in the history of American theater.
You wound up working on Come Blow Your Horn, although you lost Barefoot in the Park. But yeah. How long before you came up with the idea for All in the Family?
I was Eddie and I were back in New York doing the Martha Ray Show. We were doing very well, and I was being divorced. It was I've been married three times. It was my first divorce, and I was having a very, very difficult time. A fellow came to see me named Phil Sharp. He was a writer. Also, he had done the I Married Joan, the show that starred Joan Davis, one of the original comedies on television.
I can still sing the theme song, I Married Joan.
Oh, my goodness. I want to dance to
that. So I watched it.
You watched it. He was getting divorced. He had five kids. I only had one kid, was having all this difficulty. He had five kids, had no difficulty at all. Why? Because his wife wanted the reruns. She wanted to own the Joan Davis show. He said, take it. And he was divorced very simply with that many kids. And I said to myself, because all we had done was we were well paid, but we didn't own anything. And you had to have a situation coming in the year to own a television show. So I, at that moment, made up my mind someday soon, I've got to write a situation comedy. And soon after that, I read about this British show called Till Death Us Do Part by Johnny Spate, a British show. And oh, my God, it was my dad and me. So it amazed me that I hadn't thought of it before that.
My guest is Norman Lear. He's written a memoir called Even This I Get to Experience. It is published by Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It took a while to get it off the ground. And originally you wanted Mickey Rooney for Archie Bunker?
No, I didn't. I was seeing actors in New York and had a thought about Mickey Rooney. Mm-hmm. I was in New York and I called long distance. I knew his manager very well, a fellow by the name of Red Doff. I called Red and I said, I have an idea for Mickey Rooney. He said, well, he's here. He's right here in the office. Why don't you talk to him? This is a sensitive idea. It's a different kind of character. I'm coming out there next week anyway. I'd prefer to tell him in person. Rooney evidently knew from what he was saying I had something to tell him. He said he was yelling. He wanted to get on the phone. Anyway, I had to talk to Rooney, who spoke of himself in the third person. And he said, hi, Norm, it's the Mick. What do you want to tell the Mick? I said, well, I'm coming out there in a little bit. Can I meet you and tell you in person? You got something to tell the Mick? Tell him on the phone. He can hear it. I said, well, the character, it's a very funny show, but the character is a bit of a bigot. He'll say Spade. He'll say Hebe. He'll say he's a bigot. And Rooney said, they're going to kill you, Norm. They're going to shoot you dead in the streets. You want to do a TV show with the Mick? Listen to this. Vietnam vet, short, blind, large dog. That was my conversation.
But you wound up
Mickey,
finding Carol O'Connor. He proved to be difficult as well. He tried to rewrite the pilot for you?
Yeah, he read, I mean, the minute he read three sentences from the, you know, the opening of the pilot, he was Archie. And nothing, by the way, that I imagined. I don't remember what I imagined, but he just inhabited the role in an instant. And then I said, you got it very quickly. And he said, how long are you going to be here? I said, another couple of days. He said, can I come back and see you again? When he came back, I had given him a script to take home. He had rewritten the first act entirely. And
why? Because he thought the character was too unlikable?
I don't remember that he thought the character too unlikable. It's just that he saw it differently. He rewrote it. I loved what I had written. I wasn't going to have that. And I said, we're going to do this. And, you know, if you can, in the course of rehearsals, we'll make changes and so forth. I'll be wide open for changes. But I can't accept the rewrite. You're going to do this. And he took the role. But he never thought we'd get on the air.
And the focus groups didn't respond all that well.
No, it was amazing to sit behind a glass and look at 30 people watching the pilot after we'd made it. And they had dials. If they didn't like it, they turned to the left. If they liked it, they turned to the right. So I'm watching them laughing. I can't hear a word, but I can see their backs arching and going forward with these belly laughs. And they're turning it. I don't like it. But they were reacting to the words. They didn't want anybody to know they were laughing at Archie. And so, you know, it was... those tests were bad.
And then you almost missed your first airtime because you were having a fight with the network about the phrase 11:10 on a Sunday morning. Why was that so controversial?
Well, it was Archie and Edith coming in from church over a Sunday morning, and he had hated the sermon, so they left early. They were not expected. Mike and Gloria, having the place alone, were running upstairs. They were caught that way. And Archie could see clearly what they were up to. And he said, just that, or at 11:10 of a Sunday morning. And they thought that was, just pointed to it too harshly.
Too risque.
Too risque, yeah.
Did you constantly have to fight with them, or did things get easier once the show became a huge hit?
Well, certainly things became easier once it was a huge hit. But then, you know, we... came to, as an example, a show in which Mike, suffering from too much hard work, he was graduating from college. There was a question about tests coming up and so forth. And he lost his ability to perform physically with his wife. And she was talking to Edith about her problem, who couldn't handle it. But the network couldn't handle the subject matter.
What about the transgender show? Did they like that one?
Oh, the transgender show. I'll never forget the transgender show. I'll never forget the transgender show, especially at this moment, when the greatest thing I may have, maybe the greatest thing I'm seeing on television today, is a show called Transparent, with Jeffrey Tambor in the role of a lifetime. Walking a line between hilarity and heartbreak I've rarely seen.
Well, he is a brilliant actor.
Brilliant.
But so was Carol O'Connor. Although it seems like you had a constant fight with him. He was really upset about the elevator show to the point where he wept at a meeting that was called to discuss his problems with it.
Yeah, five people were caught in an elevator that stopped coming down from a high floor. And he was alone with a black guy who was reading the New York Times while he had the New York Daily News. And something was made of that. Then came a question. Latina woman and her husband got in. She was 2 weeks from having her baby. The elevator got stuck. She panicked, and the baby was coming. And he couldn't imagine being in an elevator for those minutes and having a baby born. And what I was interested was the camera on his face as the first sounds of birth were heard.
He, despite the problems, he wound up continuing with Archie's Place. And then you had a whole bunch of other shows, and every one of them must have freaked out the networks when you came up with the idea. Well, it was Sanford and Son, which was also based on a British show, wasn't it? But it starred Red Fox, who was one of the most famous blue comics of his time.
Well, he was blue in Las Vegas. He was blue off camera every minute. Every minute he existed off camera, but on camera he was Fred Sanford.
And then Maude, who originally appeared on All in the Family.
Right.
Had you known Bea Arthur before?
I had seen her. I knew her by then. I had seen her in a show when she sang a song called Garbage. It was unforgettable. Somebody who was treating her like garbage. But I had brought her out when I was doing the George Gobel show before Maude.
You did George Gobel as well.
Oh. I did. I brought her out as a guest star many times.
We can't go over all of the other shows.
Why not?
Because we're running out of time. But
why is that?
There was Good Times, which upset some people in the black press because unlike some of the other shows like Cosby or The Jeffersons, which you created later, this was about a black family that was really struggling. What about Jimmy Walker? You do have to tell me about that. Did the rest of the cast like it when he said dynamite?
Well, the rest of the dynamite became a catchphrase with him. And the problem with dynamite was we were on every week for 22 weeks. In Great Britain, when they did shows, they were on for 6 or 8 weeks. Mm. And cable television today, it's a little more, 6-8 weeks is a run. But we were on 22 weeks. Dynamite worked. He got big laughs with Dynamite. And he, in the long run, he said perhaps said it too often. But what happened with the other actors was a bit of jealousy. It was too easy for him to get the huge laughs he got.
He also did Mary Hartman, which some people think was one of the most brilliant shows ever.
I adored it.
And that was your favorite?
I don't know if it was my favorite, but it was clearly the only show that had something on its mind. It was very clear at the very first show and ended a couple of hundred shows later, because we were on 5 nights a week, with the same essence it began with.
And that was a comedy soap opera, something that nobody had ever thought of doing before. There also were movies. You were involved with Divorce American Style, The Princess Bride, Stand By Me, This Is Spinal Tap, among others. But people will always associate you with television. Is that okay with you?
Well, we had 9, 10, 11 shows on the air, and they were on every week through the year. Of course, they would remember me more for that.
Is it true that you're planning another sitcom for aging baby boomers called Look Who Died?
For your generation up through mine.
So you're 92 years old. You're not content to rest on your laurels?
Well, not so long as the establishment thinks that one Betty White doth a demographic make. I love her, and she's glorious, but she doesn't make a demographic, and we're underserved, and I'd like to see us.
You also got into politics? And created a it's not a pack.
People for the American Way.
Yeah. And is that still is that getting involved in the current election cycle?
It says Vital. That's Right Wing Watch, which they can find on the net. Is one of the great pieces of active literature I know.
Norman Lear, his memoir. People are going to have to read this book to get all of the other interesting stories.
They'd better read it, or they're going to hear from me.
Even This I Get to Experience. It's published by Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I couldn't be more grateful. Thank you.